You know, I'd been working on the boat for so long leading up to the departure. And so leaving Georgia, it was almost like there was a sense of redemption. There was just like a sense of this is what it's all for. And I don't know. I didn't even really know where I was going. All I knew is that I was leaving. And it was probably the most exciting moment of my life up to that moment.
Inspiring stuff, huh? Today I'm talking with Brian and Debbie of the good ship Don Treader. Here we go. Greetings. You're listening to the Bonnie Boat Sailing Podcast. My name is Chris Smith. Whether you're a grizzled old salt, pining for the days of wire rope halyards, or a greenhorn, wondering what the hell a dolphin striker is, this is the podcast that seeks to fill the need for everybody's third most favorite pastime, that is, talking about sailing. Greetings, internet users. Welcome to this, the most current episode of the Bonnie Boat. I'm very excited today to bring this conversation to you. Debbie and Brian aboard Don Treader have done some really cool stuff, and I think you'll hear in the interview they are sailors, if that makes any sense. They speak eloquently and earnestly about their experiences over the course of several Atlantic crossings, a major refit, and their more recent travels through Brazil and into Uruguay. I think their comfort with being at sea, or maybe their comfort with their discomfort of the sea, is apparent, as is their love of sailing and challenging themselves. So this is a good one. Without further commentary on my part, I bring you Brian and Debbie, the fine crew of the fine ship Don Treader. So you guys have done a lot of sailing. You've got several Atlantic crossings under your belt. You've traveled off the beaten path quite a bit. But I thought we'd start maybe with where you are now, which is Boca del Cufre in Uruguay. Is that right?
That's right.
And what's it like in Uruguay? I don't know much about the country. What's it like traveling and spending time there?
Well, it's a country with about 3 million people, and it's about the size of Georgia. And half that population is in Montevideo. So it's really kind of sparsely populated. It's a lot of just fields. I think there's 12 million cows here and 3 million people. So that's kind of telling, I think. But it's a lovely country. It's taken us a while to find a little nook that we could anchor in. It's a pretty exposed coast, and the weather here can get pretty, it can be violent sometimes. So you have to stay in these marinas for the most part. But we, after I don't know, almost a year of being here, we finally found a place that we could nook up in and anchor and live the cheap life.
Very nice. That sounds good. Do you speak much Spanish at all?
I would say no, not at all. But I don't know. I speak it better than I ever have before, and Debbie speaks it a little bit better than I do. So we're not fluent, but we get by just fine.
Cool. And what's the sailing like down there? You have some fairly intense weather. Is it pretty wild?
It can be. We're in the variables. So, we left the tropics in Brazil, and the weather patterns here, are dictated by cold fronts coming up, from the southern. And they call the cold fronts Pomperos here, which is, it's really just a cold front, but they're particularly violent because of the topography of the land around here. It's very flat and dry, and it just creates a kind of a tumultuous soup for the meteor around here. But I mean, it's very quick moving. So, you know, it'll blow hard out of the southwest for a day, and then it starts to get back to normal. But usually these fronts pass through about once a week, or sometimes a little more frequently.
Gotcha. So you're kind of having to keep an eye out for that. So where are you guys holed up at the moment? What's is that Boca del Cufre? What's that like?
It's a really neat little spot. We actually had some friends from a nearby marina in Juan Lacase drive us over here because they thought we would like it so much, and we were completely unaware. We touched bottom on the way into this little river. It's basically an offshoot of the Rio de la Plata, the Rio Cufre, I think. And we touched bottom on the way in, but there's a nice guy who runs the yacht club, which is at the entrance to the river where we recently hauled out, using his crane to paint the bottom of the boat. And let's just say it's quiet. It's what we would say is very tranquilo, very small beach town, nice, beautiful river with a peaceful anchorage for us. So we can anchor anywhere up and down.
Yeah, I think we just totally guessed, but we estimated maybe 50 people live here.
Yeah, wow. It's too, so there's not a lot of beachgoers. It'll pick up a little bit, but we'll probably be gone by the time they get into full summer swing here.
Yeah, so. Cool. That sounds pretty idyllic. That sounds cool. So let's back up a bit. So you guys are in Uruguay, but how did you guys go about gaining the experience that's brought you from, I guess, Georgia, several transatlantics? You know, how did you kind of get to where you are now, and how did you guys end up sailing around together?
Well, before we ever left with Don Treader, I went to Georgia. I was single-handing at the time, and I went to Brunswick, Georgia to work with James Baldwin. And Debbie is from the area, and we just met literally a month before I left to go on the first Atlantic loop. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a planned Atlantic loop, but after I met Debbie, I looped back and picked her up.
Very nice. And what was it like leaving for that first trip? So was that, Debbie, were you on board for that first Atlantic loop?
No, we sort of, like Brian said, we had barely met just a month prior to his departure, and this whole world of people even doing Atlantic crossings or any ocean crossings on sailboats was foreign to me. And so I was at home sending Brian text messages on the DeLorme when he took off, and I had no concept of what he was what the undertaking was or what he was really up to.
Gotcha. So Brian, did you single hand that first trip?
Well, yeah, the first leg was from Georgia to Bermuda, and that was single handed. And then the second leg was from Bermuda to the Azores, and my brother joined me for that leg.
Cool.
But yeah, it was that was 2014, I think.
So talk about maybe Brian on your, so what it felt like leaving on your first big ocean trip, and then Debbie, maybe talk about what it felt like for you leaving then a few years later on that leg.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I'd been working on the boat for so long, leading up to the departure. It was, you know, like two years of pretty much a full-time commitment when I wasn't working. And I only worked half the year. I was a merchant mariner, so I had quite a bit of time off. And I worked nonstop, basically, for 2 years on Don Treader. And so it was a lot of I'm not sure I'm ever going to get this done feeling.
Yeah.
And so leaving Georgia, it was almost like, I don't know, like it really felt liberating. Like like there was a sense of redemption. There was just like a sense of, this is what it's all for. And, you know, I left my job behind, and I was just leaving. And I don't know. I didn't even really know where I was going. All I knew is that I was leaving, and it was probably the most exciting moment of my life up to that moment.
Cool. Cool. And Debbie, how did you feel then, leaving on your first trip?
Well, I guess there was a bit of experience before that. I flew out to the Canary Islands for 2 weeks to meet Brian on that first loop. And so I had a little bit of time on the boat. And then after just those 2 weeks, I came back and made arrangements to leave my jobs and join him in the Caribbean. So I had like 3 months sailing in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Cool.
Experience, you know, from St. John back up through Puerto Rico and the Bahamas to Florida. And so I knew a little bit of what I was getting into because I had like a 5-day passage, but I can't even exactly remember the feeling. I think I was just sort of, when we launched off, I think I was just sort of, I knew I was going to try my best and I was going to do my best, but I was really not sure how I would physically handle the trip. And I was very unsure, I guess, but I was also very excited about the prospects. And I knew that there was so much promise in living aboard a small sailboat from the short window that I'd had in those prior 3 months that I was into it. So.
Cool. Cool. And I guess, so your time, you flew out to the Canaries, that kind of hooked you, that time you spent on the boat out there?
Definitely. And, you know, there's some funny things that happened because I was so inexperienced. There was just a mix of we were sailing back from La Gomera to try to catch my flight, which probably, as everybody knows, a timeline on a sailing trip isn't all the greatest idea, but we had a really, you know, a decent squall and some wind acceleration between the islands. And I put on dry fallies, Brian's, of course, and I put the jacket on. I was just like nervous and didn't know what was going on, and overalls over the jacket, and then got back to the cockpit. And so a wave came and jumped over the side of the boat and went all down the trousers I was wearing. Side of the dry fallies. So.
Yeah, I didn't have the heart to tell her she put it on backwards.
Yeah.
That's all she could do to put it on that the way she did.
Yeah, there. I mean, so I won't say that the Canary Islands experience was all, you know, this like glorious sunshine and perfect anchorage. There was a mix, which is good because it definitely represented, you know, it's always a mix. So, but I was definitely hooked on it. And we kind of discussed having a reasonable timeline for me to transition into sharing the life with Brian.
Cool. Cool. So I know you guys have, you have an outboard motor on a bracket off the stern. So I assume that means, your motoring range at sea is zero. Is that accurate?
Well, no, I mean, we are, initially thought it would be zero. We figured that we wouldn't be able to motor at all in a swell, and we proved that wrong coming down the Brazilian coastline, where we were becalmed in some pretty big swells, and we motored along just fine. But we haven't actually ever motored at sea for a transocean crossing. But I think we could. I mean, we carry about 10 gallons of gas, so I think that would get us maybe 100 miles. So
Yeah.
Not really a big option for us.
Right. And I guess what I'm really interested in is how do you approach sailing in light airs or in comms? I saw in some of your YouTube videos, it looks like you've got a big old like drifter or nylon drifter or something like that.
We have a, our primary light wind sail is a Code Zero. We also have an asymmetrical, not a spinnaker, like a, you know, one of the fake, a cruising spinnaker, I think
cool.
is.
Yeah.
We don't really use that. Honestly, we don't really use light wind sails at all. I mean, we have flown the Code Zero just a handful of times, but typically our big Genoa keeps us moving all the way up until, 5 knots of wind, and we'll just fly it. And then when it dips under 5 knots, we'll put up the Code Zero, but it doesn't do, I mean, we're just dead in the water. it's like, we could go faster under the Code Zero quite often, but we're usually pretty satisfied with the way the Genoa is driving us, so we just keep it up out of laziness.
That sounds pretty reasonable. What about weather info offshore? Are you guys getting using SSB, or do you have anything like that to get weather reports?
In the North Atlantic, we use the combination of shortwave radio WeatherFax on the iPad, mm-hmm. and we have a DeLorme and Reach, which it was before there was weather forecasting available on the DeLorme and Reach, which is now a feature, but at the time it wasn't a feature, and friends would just send me a little weather forecast occasionally, but the primary forecasting in the North Atlantic was the shortwave radio and the iPad WeatherFax decoder, I guess, some app that we have.
Cool. And that worked well for you guys?
Yeah, it worked well because the WeatherFaxes are so good in the North Atlantic, and the weather up there is pretty, I don't know, it's a little bit, we're a little more comfortable with the weather up there, I guess. But for the southern hemisphere, we have since got an Iridium Go and a Predict Wind account, so we've kind of stepped up our weather forecasting tools a little bit.
Cool. That sounds good. So I wanted to ask you guys about Dawn Treader, about your boat. I know you did a massive refit and did a lot of work on her. So maybe just tell us about Dawn Treader. What shape was she in when you bought her? What made you look for looking at the, you know, the Allied Sea Winds and some of the work that you guys did?
Well, we love this boat. It was in great shape when I first bought it. It was minimally equipped, although it had basically a brand new diesel engine in it, which is ironic because we just took it out and sold it for but other than the diesel, everything else was pretty original but well kept. The boat was in fine condition.
I would say most of the work that you did before I met you was external. Like, you did rigging work, you did fiberglass on the hull, you did things like that, and then a lot of the second refit, Chris, was probably internal to the boat. She's really a special sailboat. She has a great feeling when you step aboard. It's just sort of magical on this boat. I really love it.
Yeah, my previous boat was actually a Pearson Ariel.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because I know we corresponded a little bit about that. So obviously that's a boat that's near and dear to my heart. What did you think of the Ariel, and what made you kind of go up to the next size up there?
Oh, I love that Ariel. I think I was listening to one of your previous podcasts, and I heard that you were from the Northern Neck, which is The aerial that I had is currently in Carter Creek off the Rappahannock.
Yeah, that's wild. I mean, that's we actually recently moved the boat, but she was on, I mean, probably a 20-minute sail from there. Literally right there.
Yeah, so, but it, you know, it was, at the time, the boat was just chock full of my stuff, and I thought it was stuff that I just could not get rid of. And so I said, I just need a bigger boat. And I got a bigger boat, and since all that stuff is gone, and I think now it's like, you know what, Debbie, our insurance policy is we're going to get a Pearson aerial if we ever lose this boat.
And he even talks about refitting one up and everything, even though we have Don Treader, just because he loves the idea of it. And I'm a little glad we have some wiggle room in this boat. You know, I mean, I could bring the extra stuff that I thought I needed aboard, came on board. So it gives you a little bit of that capacity, especially when you first start sailing.
Yeah, it's pretty tight for two people.
Yeah, you know, the bunks didn't fit me very, very adequate. It wasn't quite adequate, but you don't remember those things.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. So now, when you guys were doing the second refit on Don Treader, was that you were working full time?
On the refit, yes. We were back in Georgia, and you know, Brian was meeting my family, and we were basically working on the boat full time. I had a little bit of work, you know, regular job kind of stuff, and I was teaching some classes, but otherwise it's full time fiberglass dust and things like that.
That sounds pretty intense. And how long were you guys at it?
It was a year. We got back to Georgia in April, maybe, and we left the next May, a year later. So it was pretty much a year of working. And we took a month or two off to go visit family around the country, but mostly we're working the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Yeah, and I've watched some of your videos, and I know on James Baldwin's channel, he has an episode where he kind of takes you through some of the work that you guys did, and it's a hell of a project. It's really, really cool to see what you did. And I'd like to kind of just nerd out about it a little bit. So I know you have the double Vang set up. How do you use that?
Well, the first Atlantic loop, I had one boom Vang, and I would just set it off to whatever side the boom was on. Leading it to the mast, like many Vangs you see, wasn't a very good fit for Don Treader because the angle was so acute. Mm-hmm. So I would always have to move it whenever we jibed. And there was also this like period of time when we jibed where the boom was kind of at its own devices. And so I thought, well, if I put a second boom Vang up, not only would I never have to move the boom Vang again, but I could also control the jibe with the, the other boom Vang.
Gotcha. Ease it over with the Vang, with the Vang that's like going to be the lazy Vang or something like that.
Right. And so now the boom is just always in our control.
Yeah. Yeah. That's neat. That's cool. Let's see. What else do I have here? What about, so did you add the strong track on the mast, or was that with the boat when you bought her?
Yeah, I did that. That was one of the first. So like the refits, there was many
ongoing,
many little micro phases, I guess. And that was like phase one was get new sails and put a strong track in. And the strong track has been great. It's still holding up, and it really gives us frictionless sail control, which is pretty amazing. We can reef going dead downwind, which most boats can't do that. So we've really tried to set the boat up for easy sail handling.
Cool. Yeah, that's awesome. That's neat. So what has been your toughest passage to date?
Probably the most recent one, I would think, sailing from Ilha Bela, Brazil, to Piriápolis, Uruguay. It wasn't a particularly miserable passage. Like, I think we've had passages where we've had greater misery. It was short-lived misery, and then the weather would get fair, and we'd be like, "Oh, this is glorious!" But we didn't really have that coming down to Uruguay. It was kind of.
I remember feeling like I was building some character or something. I was learning about patience, and a lot of that was happening. But we did. We were hove to, and we just weren't moving forward. We were actually going backwards. For periods of time, we holed up in a bay for like, I don't know, was that a week?
Yeah.
And the winds were very strong, and we didn't feel comfortable trying to land the dinghy on the beach. And we were just stuck on the boat, and it was a lot of strong wind action around.
We had to take like whatever kind of positive that we could. And at one point we crossed the maritime border between Uruguay and Brazil. I'm like, hey, Deb, look, we're off Uruguay now. Like, we're on there. Yeah. And then we got hit by another pampero and got basically forced right back into Brazil. And
want to tell me that. That's happened.
It took like another 2 or 3 days to get back into Uruguay.
Wow.
Yep. Sort of a backwards loop, just sliding back. But that one was tough. And I think the first one I took was probably tough on the way to Bermuda, because I really wasn't used to, going into the wind. And the noises were something that was sort of astonishing to me. I didn't realize that I was traveling in a drum. that when a wave touches the front of it with any force at all, it's going to make quite a noise. So that was one thing that shocked me. But there were also good moments in that passage, which you mostly remember those, and it all balances out, I guess. And you think of them in the past as mostly just sort of charming.
the Bermuda passage?
Yeah.
There was one point during that passage when we were going through a squall line.
Oh, yeah, and I was on watch, and I called you out because I could see the lightning and stuff.
Yeah, like, we're going through a squall, and we'd reefed down. We're triple reefed. We had our jib just like a little handkerchief flying. We had next to nothing. And we're like, okay, let's get our foul weather gear on so that we can, stand by. And it just started just... going crazy on us. And we just look at each other like, what are we doing outside?
Yeah.
Why are we out here right now? This is insane.
We've had a few experiences like that where like, I guess we don't have to be out here during this.
Let's just go inside and just wait for it to be over.
Yeah. So that was definitely a beginner moment for me. Like, I'm sitting out here watching the squall, and then wait, it's on top of us. We're soaking wet.
Yeah. And you guys don't have a Dodger, is that right?
No.
No, we don't have a Dodger. And there's been a lot of Dodger talk on this boat. It's really a great setup with our dinghy, and we have a nesting dinghy with a small hatch that we cut a hole for and installed back in 2015. So we have air coming in the boat, and we have this dinghy, but with that and the new companionway hatch, I guess, it's very hard to design a Dodger for this boat, and I don't think it's something Brian's all that interested in.
No, I'm not. I have no interest in it.
you like standing out in it?
The reason Debbie wants a Dodger is because people tell her that.
No. I think the elements, like, I'm I think I'm just more sensitive to them, like wind in my ears, that's wind true. On my face. You know, I feel it, the noise of the wind. But, you know, honestly, Brian might tell you he doesn't want a Dodger, but Brian also loves what he calls pajama sailing, where he can stand in the companionway. He can, you can work with the main sheet. You figured that out from the companionway. You can work with the jib sheet. And you can adjust the self-steering. So
sip your coffee and hang out. That sounds great.
In his socks, yeah, in his pajamas.
Yeah, that's my primary goal for any passage is not to have to leave my pajamas.
Yeah. But we do shade ourselves from the sun, and we have an awning that we put up, but, you know, it's not really a traditional Dodger, I guess. And we've had good sailing so far without one.
We have nice dry, we have dry suits now, so.
Oh, yeah, cool. We did. Cool, yeah.
Those are our Dodgers, I guess.
self-contained Dodgers, yeah. Wearable Dodgers. Right. But that's kind of a good segue because you guys, you know, you're on a relatively small boat, and you've taken some kind of, I don't know, maybe unconventional ways of doing things, and they're kind of different from what you see in the magazines or kind of the, you know, the yachting blueprint. So maybe you can just talk about your overall philosophy, and how you've been able to arrange your lives in order to go sailing.
Wow. Some things that I've noticed just because in the beginning I was sort of a tag along to this. And so as I was partially outside observer to what happened to John Treader and sort of the refit that we did and getting to do the refit, I started to understand more of the elements of the boat a lot better. And I think that we try to, you know, in many ways keep things as simple as possible. For the design of our systems and just the overall feel of, you know, if we're gonna have a stove, like, well, let's make it an inexpensive stove that's really easy to work and it's great in all weather. And that's the Adam stove that James put together and welded the top for. And that's an example of something that you can replace for like $30 if it breaks. Or something like that. So there's a simplicity to what we're trying to do, so that we can keep doing it.
Yeah, we're looking for longevity, sustainability, and we're looking to learn. Like we're really trying to set our home and our lives up for observation and really evolving our sailing skills and our liveaboard skills. And it took me a while to figure out that those are two different things and they need to be in harmony with each other. And it's a big, daunting learning process. But, I think that's the thing that I look for the most is just being able to learn and try to, keep it going as long as we can.
Cool. And what do you find most challenging about doing that, about living aboard?
We're out of our comfort zone a lot. John Treader is this little haven and we call it our bubble and we feel good, inside her. But when you pop your head up, sometimes you feel like you're on the edge of the earth and you might just get blown off. And it's just sort of, it's always like we don't speak perfect Spanish and we want to learn. We've tried,
we've been doing,
the Spanish apps,
Duolingo, but the
fact is we don't really speak the language. And so we live in a place where we can't really talk to people. And it's always being out of our comfort zone is probably the most challenging aspect of it all.
And what keeps you guys engaged? You say you're trying to learn, you're trying to arrange your lives to learn. Is that also kind of the attraction?
Certainly. I think, you know, lifelong learning is really important and very valuable to both of us. And being aboard the boat, like, I'm so far removed from the things I used to be learning about, you know, and the things like on land that I was learning, but I also felt a little bit more sure of things. And I've come to a point in this way that we're living has given me the opportunity to realize just how much I don't know and how uncertain things can be. However, I think that teaches you a lot, and you get to be creative, because maybe you've never been in a circumstance similar at all. When, you know, traveling in general does that for anybody, I think, puts you in different and new circumstances. So you have that opportunity to learn and just realize, yeah, maybe I don't have any clue about about the world, but pretty happy with that. So
yeah, we go through a lot of periods of time where we just, well, I go through a lot of times where it's just like, I don't feel like I know anything about any of this.
We're always trying to figure something out, but it does give you a lot of space to be creative when you're in those situations, or you're just in a lifestyle where you're not really, you know, we don't keep a schedule per se. I mean, we definitely are in tune with the weather, and that dictates a lot of our schedule, and where we want to go, you know, dictates a lot of our scheduling. But there's so much flexibility. It was almost unnerving to begin with, but once you sort of get comfortable with that, it's really nice.
Cool. No, that sounds, I mean, that's great. That's great. What do you think in terms of, what part of that kind of Venn diagram is the sailing aspect, and what part of is the travel, or is it kind of the interplay between the two?
Well, for me, I mean, I've always loved travel, but when I discovered sailing, traveling took a backseat. Like, it's definitely a big part of it. And I mean, I don't know, I guess it didn't really take the back seat. It's just, it became swallowed by sailing. Sailing is obviously a big part of sailing. If I just really loved sailing and didn't love travel, we would have never, I don't know, I would have never left. But I don't know.
There's certain elements to sailing, like a long passage, for example, where it sort of, it allows you to step away from certain patterns of thought. Like when we first left the U.S. East Coast, and especially in the passage to the Azores, which was like 3 weeks, by the time we got there, I wasn't sure that I wanted to stop sailing, because there are so many components to it that allow you to, like, you know, break away from, especially since it was such a radical change for me, break away from ways that you were thinking before, you know, you left. And that creates a lot of space to learn new things. So I'm not really sure. I think the sailing component is pretty big as far as the Venn diagram goes.
Cool. No, that's great. And I know, yeah, for me, I certainly, you know, haven't traveled nearly as widely as you guys have, but there is something magical about arriving somewhere under sail. It's definitely, sailing's great and traveling's great, but there's kind of, there's a kind of a heady mixture there.
Yeah, definitely. You're right. It's a unique feeling. Rather than, you know, if you go by plane somewhere and you're filtered through an airport, like, that's such a different way to enter a country. I can't remember whose blog you were reading where they said that sailing to a country and trying to clear in with the officials is like going to somebody's house and, like, you know, tiptoeing through the back door. to the right spot, because it's so odd. it's definitely unusual combo.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, I know, so you guys were in Brazil, and at one point you were boarded and robbed, which sounds terrifying. And I guess I'm interested in hearing what kind of what you took away from that, and if there's anything you're doing now in terms of security on the boat that's different than you were doing before.
It's almost as if we're doing less now, which is a little bit kind of funny. But we're in Uruguay, and it is so peaceful here. And, you know, we're sharing the river with it's a kind of a fish camp along the riverbank here with different families and fishermen on their boats. And it's just a very peaceful place. And like we said, the size of the town is so small that, you know, it's one of those great places where you really don't feel worried about anything in that regard. And in Brazil, I think the experience that we had was, you know, I get into a little hindsight about it. Well, I definitely had a gut feeling when we first started going up that river. And I definitely had a gut feeling when we came home from our buddy boat the night before at dinner, and things were like sort of feeling strange in that river, and we felt watched, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We were anchored in front of a town that was more of a verging on city than town that we thought, you know. There was a lot of people there, and it was carnival. It was, things were going a little crazy. So I guess I don't remember the question exactly, but
well, we came out of it the best that we really could have. I mean, I was just sitting outside and this boat approached us. It wasn't very late.
It was dark,
but it had just gotten dark. And I was just sitting outside. Debbie was making food, and this boat approached us, and I just thought it was another random boat that approaches us. It happens occasionally. And I told them, no, we don't want any. I figured that they were just
selling fish or something.
Mm-hmm. And as soon as I said that, they basically rammed us, jumped on board, and they all had guns, and it was
It
just happened very quickly. And I guess the learning experience is that just if you are in a place where it can happen, then if you expose yourself to those places enough, then it probably will happen. I mean, we aren't a particularly flashy boat by any means, and
neither was our buddy boat, and we both got robbed the same night, like them and then us, and in the same anchorage, we were the only two boats there. And I guess, you know, when we got back to Itaparica, which is a bigger anchorage, you know, in Bahia, we like talked to our friends, and, you know, we reported everything. And it was, I don't know, I guess we were just thankful that nothing else happened.
Yeah.
You know, we're okay. And both of us handled it pretty well. I think most people handle those things fairly well, because you're put into the present moment really quickly, and you just act without thinking. And I think we did our best. I remember, you know, one of the things that I was doing to cope with the situation as we left the river that night, like we went to, it was the Rio Paraguaçu, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to the mouth of the river to anchor because we didn't want to stay in that same spot overnight, obviously.
Yeah.
And, we went to the mouth of the river, and I remember, like, we were navigating out, and I was on the bow, and, you know, I just had a really nice chocolate bar, and just sort of calmed myself down eating chocolate. And I think that, you know, we don't want to make light of situations like that, but I think we took away just being thankful that everything was okay and we were fine.
It definitely made it watchful, but I mean, They didn't get anything too terribly important, so it was all right.
Yeah, it was just stuff, just money stuff, you know?
yeah. No, it sounds like, it sounds like you guys came away from it kind of, with a good lesson. And Did that color your experience in Brazil at all, or do you guys still have a good time there?
We had a great time there. The boat that we were sailing with is a German couple with their child. We made great friends with them. And in addition, we made some other really good friends in the anchorage in Itaparica that we hopped down to Ilha Grande with. And the different spots that you go to in Brazil they're really different from each other. And when we left Bahia, like near Salvador, Salvador's just sort of intense. For me, at least, I'm not really a big city.
Is it a big city? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big city, and it's just, you know, like we were in the tourist area one day, and we're seeing like big vans getting ready and posting up in certain spots for the night with like a major police force. You know, kind of. It just felt like some places in the Americas do. Like there's a lot of things, a lot of action.
Yeah.
In all parts of the world, I guess there's just these big hubs of action and people, and that's one of the things that I was sort of relieved to take a break from as we sailed south and we went to all these beautiful little spots, and you know, we're met with a lot of friendliness. Brazilians are sort of overtly very, very friendly, and we enjoyed that. We, you know, I would say overall, Brazil was a great experience for sailing. There were so many anchorages. It was awesome.
Yeah, it's fantastic sailing Brazil, especially once you get to Ilha Grande. Mm-hmm. It's it's just thousands of lush paradise style anchorages.
Yeah.
Cool. Very cool. So speaking of, I guess, cruising grounds here, I saw you guys recently installed a wood stove in anticipation of heading south to Patagonia, which sounds like a true adventure. So talk about what draws you there and what kind of preparations you're making for heading further south.
Well, I think I'm not really sure what the draw is. It's always been there since we left to go sailing. You know, we want to get to the Pacific, and we didn't really want to go through the Panama Canal. We weren't even sure the outboard could get us through the Panama Canal at the required speed. But it's more than that. I mean, it just seems kind of fabled, and we just wanted to go check it out, and we wanted to challenge ourselves. And so we made a lot of our original modifications to Don Treader with the idea of Patagonia in mind. And since arriving to Uruguay, we have continued some of those modifications and additions. And the wood stove is one of those. So we love the little thing.
Yeah. It
really makes winter something enjoyable.
Yeah, no, it's cool. It looks cozy.
It is. And I think it, you know, for me being from Georgia and not having a true sense of what cold is, probably, having a way to heat our boat is so nice, because we are headed towards colder places and I'm just not really sure how it's going to feel. So it's very cute and it works great. So it's a good combo.
Cool. And so is your thinking, you go south along Argentina and then was it the Straits of Magellan through to Chile, the Chilean side? Is that how that works?
Yeah,
sort of.
That's one option.
Yeah, yeah. The Straits of Magellan is actually, it's supposed to be a more, dangerous option than going through the Beagle Channel,
okay.
Which mm-hmm. it just passed the Straits of Lemaire, and it is where Puerto Williams and Ushuaia is. Ushuaia on the Argentine side and Puerto Williams on the Chilean side.
Okay, yeah, and I've heard of those two places. Yeah, I mean the photos I've seen from down there just look unbelievable. So that sounds like that's going to be pretty cool.
Yeah, I hope we get
it
down
really
there.
Does look spectacular. And I think that, you know, if you're asking about our planning at all, we're just, that's our focus, is to get there. And, you know, we definitely heard a lot of stories about people going north through Chile, underpowered or low powered or no engine or, you know, all of these different variables. But we're just going to wait and see what it's like before we say we're know exactly where we're going after that.
Right on. So what are the resources for, you know, finding out information about sailing there?
We have a fantastic guidebook made by a couple of Italian sailors. It's really everybody who sails to Patagonia seems to have this guidebook. It's pretty it's pretty in depth. It's like 3 inches thick, and it's got thousands of anchorages in it.
It's a very encouraging amazing book.
Too. Yeah,
cool. It really makes information to go on. I mean, it's very, very helpful looking.
That's like 90% of the resources, and then 10% is just whatever accounts that we might find on the web, which is, there's surprisingly little. There's not much information out there, so.
Cool. That sounds. I'm excited to see what you guys get into. It seems pretty cool. So I want to be respectful of your time here as well. We've been talking for almost an hour, but I've got a couple quick questions. If you've got a little bit more time.
Sure, of course.
Cool. We are in no
so. What do you have any advice for someone preparing to take a small boat offshore?
Sure. I mean, it's. It can be done. If someone wants to do it, there's no reason they can't do it. So I guess the only thing that you really need is a desire and a little bit of perseverance, and anybody can do it.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
I'd say for traveling on a small boat in general and just embarking on a new lifestyle, maybe, you know, don't get caught up in expectations about it. That's one of the things I first learned was, like, don't expect a new place to be a certain way, or don't expect when, you know, the weather's going to change somehow, but don't expect it to produce a certain outcome, because, you know, it's just a lot easier not to have those in your head ahead of time.
Yeah, no, that sounds like good advice. I know, certainly anxiety about weather changes is something I can identify with. Just letting it happen. That sounds like good advice.
Yeah, because, I mean, you're optimistic, right? But, like, if you think there's going to be some relief from something, and then, well, maybe there isn't, or maybe there is, but a new thing occurs. You know, it's just sort of difficult when you build up expectations in your mind. So yeah. I sort of got that. I'm trying.
Yeah, no, I hear that. And are you guys usually, when you pull in somewhere, are you usually the smallest boat?
Not always. A lot of the time.
A lot of times we're the only boat.
That's living the dream right there.
There's other sailboats on this river right now, but nobody's in them. And so we're sort of the only international sailors that we've seen for a while. If you're asking about international, like, voyaging boats and the size of them, I would say in Piriápolis, which is more of like a gathering point for people jumping off from Uruguay to go south or coming back the other direction. The last time we were there, there were maybe two or three boats the same or similar size and one smaller.
Yeah.
So.
Bristol 27 headed south.
Yeah. He did his trip all the way through Beagle Channel and up the Chilean canals with the Bristol 27.
Cool, yeah.
But there, you know, there's a lot of small boats out here, hopefully, more and more.
And do you guys find that there's often other young people on small boats, or is it mostly you and a bit of an older crowd?
Well, in the North Atlantic, I felt like there was just a mix between the two. You know, there wasn't really a rule as to whether people were older and were, you know, starting sailing in retirement or had been sailing for a decade or something, or younger and just starting out. There was definitely a mix between the two, in Bermuda, in the Azores, and from there on, you know.
Cool.
Even in Brazil, there's a mix between the two. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's good. That's good to hear. What about, do you guys have a favorite sailing song?
a favorite sailing song?
Or song to sail by?
I don't know. what's that Jason Isbell and Amanda Shire's couple songs that you...
Yeah, they did like a couple of sea shanties together.
Yeah, those were cool.
Those are cool.
Nice, and I can't... nice. Yeah, I've got some friends who are really into Jason Isbell. I don't think I've heard that particular one, but I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, and I like any song that mentions a little bit of sailing, you know, and I think they're... I'm trying to think of anybody else that we really love. We listen to a lot of Gillian Welsh David Ruffin.
Yeah, love those guys.
Across the seas, so that's always beautiful music to sail to. And there's probably a couple other artists that we just love listening to full albums and things like that. Things that really go along with sort of the feeling of it all.
Yeah, at sea I don't really listen to music. I just listen to... nothing, I guess.
I sometimes put headphones in and listen to music at sea, but there is a lot of quietude as well. Sometimes just listening to the water rush by the hull is perfectly relaxing, so that's enough.
Cool, yeah. And part of the reason I ask is I know on the some of the videos you put, I always dig the tunes you have in the background. That kind of alt country sound is good stuff. I always, I'm like, yeah.
Yeah. That's my best friend's band, and he lets us use his music. It's really great stuff if you ever want to check it out.
Yeah, it's killer, for sure.
Jason McIntyre, and his band is Lamont.
Yeah.
And we've definitely had a number of, like, dance parties to his music, at least I have, on Don Shredder.
Nice.
At Anchor and things, and it's really nice for that. It's very fun music, and really it's really good. Cool. Really upbeat.
Yeah. Where are they based out of?
Jason lives in Denver, but he's got a lot of connections in State College, Pennsylvania as well.
Yep. Cool.
So he kind of back and forth between the two.
Cool. Well, I'll put a link up in the on the blog when this goes live, because it's I've enjoyed checking it out for sure.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
He's very creative, writes all his music, and it's nice to have it as a resource to work with videos, because it makes it so much more fun to make them.
yeah, for sure. I've enjoyed watching them, definitely, and the music definitely adds something.
Cool.
So what, any suggestions on who I should interview next?
Well, we could probably make you a short list. I listened to one of your podcasts before where you said you might be interested in young sailors or younger. I don't know what.
Yeah,
what
as a kind of general, as a general theme, not specifically all the time, but yeah, in general, for sure.
We've met some interesting single-handers and young couples from different places that we could tell you about.
Yeah,
I think Kate on Tranquility would be an awesome interview.
They'd be number one. They introduced us in Georgia. They were the sailors that connected the dots between us somehow, and also, you know, just the sort of circle around James Baldwin and his community of sailors in Brunswick. But they're in Panama right now.
Yeah, Panama. I think they're going to transit the canal last time I talked.
They did a refit on a Columbia 29 and took it down the east coast of the U.S. In winter, I think, in the Northeast, and have been adventuring since, making their way to Panama. So,
cool. That sounds like a prime candidate. Cool. Well, thanks. I really do appreciate your time. Do you want to? Where can people find you? I know you have some. Videos on YouTube and talk about your website.
Yeah, we have a blog, and it's active in, you know, sort of a variable cycle. But our YouTube is Don Shredder, and our website is Sailing Don Shredder. bonnieboat.com. So pretty straightforward.
Cool. Well, I really appreciate your guys' time. It's been cool following along on your blog and watching your videos. You've done some really cool sailing in inspiring ways. So it's been a privilege to talk to you, and I really appreciate you you taking the time.
Thanks a lot, Chris. We've had a great time.
Yeah, same to you, Chris. It's really nice. These podcasts are wonderful, so we really appreciate the work that you're putting into it.
Cool. Thanks. I appreciate it. It's been its own reward. I mean, the whole point is kind of to be able to have conversations like this. So, it's good stuff.
Well, hopefully we'll get to talk to you again sometime.
Absolutely.
It's very nice.
Yeah. I'll be following along. So, best of luck.
All right, Chris.
All the best, Chris. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, guys. Yep. Have a good one. Thanks again to Debbie and Brian for spending the time to speak with me. I found our conversation to be very interesting and informative. A couple things I took away from our chat. Savvy listeners will have noticed that they are using an iPad to decode weather facts as a means of getting weather offshore, which you may recall Brian Rolfe spoke about a few episodes back. So I guess all the cool kids are doing it that way. Another thing that jumped out at me is that you hear a lot of people talk about simplicity, but it seems like Brian and Debbie have really honed that craft as it applies to their sailing. I also thought the distinction that Brian made between sailing skills and liveaboard skills was interesting. It's a difference that hadn't occurred to me, but I find highly relevant to my own sailing goals. I thought it was a great chat. So if you've enjoyed this podcast, as always, I would greatly appreciate you giving me a rating and a review on iTunes, help other sailors find it. But perhaps better, even better, would be to reach out to Debbie and Brian and just let them know that you found their story interesting. So you can find them online at their blog at sailingdawntreader.com, on YouTube under the same name, and on Instagram at dineenart, I think. I should have asked Debbie how to say that. But it's spelled D-I-N-E-E-N-A-R-T on Instagram. So check them out. Thanks again. And if you're listening on the East Coast in real time here, October 1st, and you're planning on going to the Annapolis Boat Show here in a few days, there's about a 10% chance that I'm going to make it up on that Saturday. So drop me a line if you'll be around. Until next time, thanks. That's it for this episode of The Bonnie Boat. Thanks for listening. I know time is my most scarce resource these days, so I appreciate you choosing to spend your time listening here. One of the reasons I decided to throw my hat into the podcast ring is to get in touch with other like-minded sailing maniacs. To that end, if you have any comments or suggestions, you can email me at thebonnieboat@gmail.com. You can find us online at thebonnieboat.wordpress.com. And remember, to be a sailor, you don't need a YouTube channel with 100,000 video subscribers. You don't need an Instagram account with pictures of beautiful people in their bathing suits. You certainly don't need a podcast. You don't even need a boat. You just need to go sailing. Until next time, this is Firefly standing by on Channel 16.